Thank you, Carol, and thanks everyone so much for coming out today. I think next time we're just going to go with the chronology and forget all this writing stuff. We're going to take a broad but selective sweep through 150 or so years of design tonight, with a focus just on tall buildings, more or less. The book, as Carol mentioned, does cover interior design, industrial design, and a lot of other good stuff. But this being the place that we're in, we're looking at some tall buildings and not so tall buildings. So without further ado, every object within the world around us tells a story, from the contour of a tea kettle to the upward arc of a skyscraper. Next slide, please. Here we have the Michael Graves teapot for Alessi and Norman Foster's Swiss Ray Tower in London. For the last century and a half, that has been the story of modern design, a thrilling tale of invention and brio that crossed oceans, cultures, and disciplines. From the middle of the 19th century onward, the modern style has been the defining narrative of architecture, interior and industrial design, the graphic arts, and photography, stretching across Victorian England. Here we see the, next slide please, the Crystal Palace, designed by Paxton in 1851 as the prototype of a steel ribbed glass cage, and on to revolutionary Russia, post-war America, and beyond. Born at the dawn of a new machine age that brought innovations in production and an era of unprecedented change, modern design has embodied not only our aesthetic tastes, but our values, our aspirations, and increasingly our destiny as a globally connected society. Tonight we'll look at some formative tall buildings, as well as some not so talls, and some things that are frankly not tall at all, and see them against the social and cultural currents that eventually gave rise to today's super talls. We'll see how we got from the Gothic tracery of Trinity Church here in New York to the Seagram Building's sublime corporate style, and onto the 21st century's global design talent that set new standards of refinement and sustainable savvy. Along the way, we'll see, I hope, that what drives the best of modern design is not just the quest for new forms or fresh perspectives, but the ambition to build a better world. Next slide. In booming 19th century America, architects and designers, like those in England and across Europe, were profoundly divided by the Industrial Revolution. Victorians battled one another over the emerging ranks of standardized products and new factory-based modes of production that spelled misery for the masses. The English designer Lloyd Morris, next. But here is preeminent spokesman for the social dimensions of design, sought to turn back the clock to a time when artisans could be proud of their hand-tooled products and not simply cogs in a machine. Here's Morris's Red House outside of London. Apart from the desire to produce beautiful things, Morris declared, the leading passion of my life has been and is hatred of modern civilization. These biting words summed up the ever-mounting stakes in the look of a clock face or a chair leg. It's no wonder, then, that as the world changed around them, Victorians sought safe harbor in styles of the past. Gothic tracery, rococo swags, medallions, pediments, and finials sprouted from rooftops and cabinetry as waves of imitation and reproduction came and went. By 1851, much of English Victorian architecture had fallen under the sway of the Gothic revival, the most popular expression of the era's rough-hewn historicist mode. The Middle Ages were recreated virtually stone by stone here in the Houses of Parliament, destroyed by fire in 1834, but their replacements, designed by Sir Charles Barry, not completed until the 1850s, amid much fanfare about the glass and steel Crystal Palace. But Barry's irregularly silhouetted structures were resolutely neo-Gothic, adorning facades with trefoils and other designs of the decade, reaching toward even more exotic motifs, keyhole arches from Spain and minarets from the Near East. Barry and his contemporaries seemed to long for more traditional modes that borrowed moral force from the architecture of cathedrals or mosques. Dismayed by the clock-run industrial world they helped invent, these Victorian architects looked for spiritual solace in temples of the past. Designers like Owen Jones promoted all manner of eclectic styles through tomes like Jones's Grammar of Ornament, published in 1856 with colored plates explicating Greek, Roman, and Gothic, as well as Egyptian, Persian, and other Levantine styles. These superb plates helped shape nearly half a century of English wallpaper, fabric, and furniture. By 1840, Alexander Jackson Davis, next, and the New York tastemaker Andrew Jackson Downing had helped cement the public preference for these picturesque styles. Downing commissioned Davis to make sketches of neo-Gothic cottages for publication in his widely read books. Davis then persuaded wealthy patrons to build their upriver retreats in the style that came to be called Hudson River Gothic. Windhurst, seen here, the railroad magnate Jay Gould's country home and a key example of picturesque in the United States, boasts a crenellated gray-white marble tower that soars above the grounds to dramatic effect. Davis was far from the only promoter of historicist styles in America. Next. 2 years after construction began on the Houses of Parliament in London, an Englishman named Richard Upjohn began work on New York's carefully proportioned Trinity Church. That church, together with the more massive St. Patrick's Cathedral, next, of James Renwick, completed in 1878, firmly established the neo-Gothic style for American churches, and it became the go-to decor for important American structures. In some respects, then, it was a small leap from one kind of cathedral to another, next. Though dating to a slightly later period, the Woolworth Building, Cass Gilbert's masterpiece in 1913, is, along with the Brooklyn Bridge, a beautiful collision of historicist decoration and modern means. Gilbert was hired by the Five and Dime store magnate to design a Lower Manhattan landmark as, quite explicitly, a giant signboard for the burgeoning discount store empire. Woolworth himself suggested copying the tower from London's Houses of Parliament, next, borrowing a well-known European symbol and giving his own empire a fine pedigree. But Gilbert also turned to medieval municipal buildings and cathedrals in Northern Europe, drawn to their flamboyant Gothic detail and picturesque silhouettes against the sky. At 57 stories, the tallest building in the world, next, when completed, the structure melded Gothic decoration with an ultra-modern steel skeleton and an audacious program that included an interior shopping arcade, health club, swimming pool, restaurant, and observatory, all of which the historian Gail Finsky calls a symbol of the jarring discontinuities, startling proximities, and unpredictability of the modern experience. Adding to the jarring effect, next, is the arcaded lobby of lavish Sierra marble, with cathedral-like crypts and vaults that contain the fanciful grotesques of those involved in the skyscraper's construction. Next. Here's Woolworth clutching his nickels, and Gilbert with his creation. The effect was completely calculated to wow an international audience of consumers while creating a true cathedral of commerce. Next, please. By the turn of the 20th century, a new generation of designers left Gothic forms behind in their quest for a fresh decorative language. By the time of Queen Victoria's death in 1901, this new style, Art Nouveau, had advanced across the capitals of Europe and reached the surging American skylines of New York and Chicago. Where Victorian designers revived elements of Gothic and other historic styles to evoke specific associations, Art Nouveau adopted a symbolist aesthetic of form. Next, please. Peacocks, lilies, swans, and other animals and plants stand for specific ideas, replacing the Victorian penchant for anecdote. The resulting riot of organic motifs, tendrils, vines, petals, and filaments, as seen here in Victor Horta's Tassel House in Brussels of 1892, teems with a ravishing sense of life. This fecund nature of Art Nouveau was accompanied by an opposing tendency, however, in which the function of an object influenced its form. In the Victorian period, even locomotives or machine tools were not always designed to look functional, though often they were superbly so. That began to change when factory technology, which had made possible the construction of a Crystal Palace, ushered in a style that seemed to express the new age of steam-driven machinery. The facades of skyscrapers rising in Chicago and New York in the 1890s reflected functional needs within. While the innovative use of new materials, including reinforced concrete, gave designers ever greater freedom to create objects that visually expressed their uses. Thus reaching toward both the past and the future, Art Nouveau has sometimes been misunderstood. The British artist Walter Crane dismissed it as a decorative disease, next, a sickly interlude between Victorian ingenuity and modern élan. Here's Antoni Gaudí's Casa Claudio in Barcelona. The Dutch architect Pierre Cuypers deemed it a parasitic plant, a feverish fin de siècle phenomenon. Indeed, much derision was aimed at the whiplash, next please, that most popular motif of the Art Nouveau period. This is Victor Horta's Solvay House in Brussels of 1900. The offended Belgians called Art Nouveau eel style, the Germans noodle style and tapeworm style. This exotic, invasive architecture might not have embellished any American city as it did Paris, but it made its biggest splash in Chicago, next please, where the architect Louis Sullivan designed the Schlesinger and Meyer department store, better known as the Carson Perry Scott Building, which crystallized the Art Nouveau in America. Sullivan specified large windows that admitted light generously and, as his colleagues copied them, came to be known as the trademark Chicago windows. That they allowed for the maximum light needed on the selling floors shows how Sullivan applied his popular dictum, form ever follows function, to his designs. In the wrought iron of its first two floors, Sullivan went wild, however, lavishing plant-like ornament of scrolls, leaves, and flowers that would have made the Belgians proud. This fantastic ornament had bloomed in the Bayer Building, next, of 1899, the architect's only structure standing in New York, and one of the city's first steel skeleton towers. Here, Sullivan's terracotta frieze, pre-Raphaelite angels along the attic story, resting peacefully atop the structure's emphatic vertical lines, express the steel poems within. With this tower, Sullivan succeeded in creating a suitable form for the tall office building, a new genre developed in response to the growing demands of commerce. Rather than disguise this new structure behind Greek or Romanesque decoration, Sullivan searched for a design that would convey its use as an office. Next, please. It was not here, but in the Guarantee Building in Buffalo, that Sullivan most overwhelmingly succeeded. Verticality, the overriding quality of the building, as at the Bayard, was emphasized by mullions that ran from mezzanine to roof without interruption. Spandrels were set back so as not to spoil the towering effect. Ornament, next please, though concentrated in the mullions, blossomed in the attic story to terminate the structure. Sullivan's finest freestanding tall building, it is a witness hymn to American commerce. Dominating the next generation of European designers was a belief that the antidote to Art Nouveau's decorative disease was a dose of functionality. Early modern architects like Mies, van der Rohe, and graphic artists like Ella Siski made a quantum leap into the realm of no-frills, streamlined design, an ever more abstract approach that pared away excess and reduced objects to their essence. Less is more, like Mies' mantra. This approach was pioneered by the German architect Walter Gropius, who formulated the functionalist mode in his design for the Bauhaus, the German school he founded and directed in 1919. Its concrete walls and hard, glittering glass facade embodied the new world of technology. With an asymmetric floor plan, derived from the intended use of the space rather than from some notion of classical symmetry, it became the basis for an era-defining architectural style. The clean line look was called the international style, an ideal epitomized by Mies in his German pavilion for the 1929 exhibition in Barcelona, next please. Although open for only one summer, and became among the most important influences on 20th century interior and furniture design, and its 1986 reconstruction remains a pilgrimage site for architects. In the succeeding years, a diaspora of European designers landed in America and forcefully shaped the modern style. Mies in Chicago, Gropius at Harvard, Neutra in Los Angeles, and Annie Albers in North Carolina. At the Seagram Building on Park Avenue, next please, Mies achieved a 38-story triumph of modern elegance, often copied but never matched, expressing the interior steel structure with bronze-tinted I-beams on the facade, and setting the tower back within a broad granite plaza, the architect created a carefully modulated urban ensemble and an instant New York landmark. Perhaps not coincidentally, it was a restaurant in this building, designed principally by Philip Johnson, that would become the most canonical modern interior in America. Next, please. The Four Seasons opened in 1959 and prompted the Times restaurant critic to observe, "The decor is a conversation piece sufficient in itself to sustain a lively causerie throughout a leisurely lunch." Consisting of two 22-foot high column-free spaces, the restaurant was defined by its grandly minimalist gestures, a white marble reflecting pool in the pool room, and a constructivist-style sculpture of brass rods by Richard Lippold in the grill room. Sumptuous yet serene, the spaces created a theater for the unfolding drama of dining. Curtains, gold anodized aluminum chains designed by Marie Nichols, were a sublimely modern touch along the windows, augmented by tapestries from Juan Miró, curtain by Picasso, and tableware by Garth Huxtable. The menu changed with the seasons, as did the decor. Lush interior greenery sprouted firethorn in the fall, azaleas in the spring. The 50s and 60s were a high watermark for the modern skyscraper, with masterpieces like Gordon Bunshaft's Weaver House, next please, with its pioneering glass curtain wall and public plaza below. But these decades also marked a certain endpoint for the Bauhaus ideal of design as a social agenda. Even well-intentioned architects like Gropius and Ben Thompson, with colleagues at the Architects Collaborative, which designed New York's Pan Am Building, next please, with Emery Roth and Pietro Paluski in 1963, left the world of urbanity and street-scale proportion for a new realm of megalopolitan ambition. In 1981, Tom Wolfe skewered this state of affairs in his long diatribe from Bauhaus to Our House, writing, "Every child goes to school in a building that looks like a duplicating machine replacement parts wholesale distribution warehouse." He continued, "Every great law firm in New York moves without a sputter of protest into a glass box office building with concrete slab floors and 7-foot, 10-inch high concrete slab ceilings, and plasterboard walls, and pygmy corridors, and then hires a decorator and gives him a budget of hundreds of thousands of dollars to turn these mean cubes and grids into a horizontal fantasy of a restoration townhouse." Even more damning, the demolition of huge tracts like Pruitt-Igoe, next please, the legendary St. Louis public housing complex, brought the modern march of progress to a crashing halt. Pruitt-Igoe's 11-story towers were the direct descendants of Le Corbusier's Unité d'Habitation and its promise to French workers of efficient housing for all society, destroyed on live television. The stylistic innovations of Mies and Le Corbusier had hardened into a humdrum cityscape where corporate complexes stood aloof across asphalt expressways. Historical and social context had been bled from the urban core. Was this architecture's future? Next, please. The late 20th century was a time of epochal transition as the machine age rusted in the shadow of an ascendant information-based society. Just as a post-World War I economic boom helped power the early modern aesthetic, so tectonic economic shifts shaped late modern style. The arrival of electronically networked banks, businesses, and ultimately consumers helped drive new formal vocabularies as designers applied advanced technologies to office towers and apartment blocks, flatware, and photographs. Next, please. Amid an era of conflicting and painful social currents, the utopian optimism that defined the early modern era gave way to a more circumspect mode. Whereas earlier designers had aimed for universality, the pared-down functionalism of Bauhaus designs was not just a style, but a moral imperative. Postmodern thinkers embraced diverse influences and styles from the past. This led to a decade of jarring and contrasting aesthetics. The same year that Richard Rogers was building the swaggering Lloyds of London, seen here, a tour de force of futuristic forms in the best tradition of modern experimentation, Philip Johnson and John Vergy came out with the 37-story skyscraper, next please, whose top was borrowed from the 18th-century English cabinet maker Thomas Chippendale. This was their AT&T building, typifying the eclectic impact of postmodernism, a trend violently opposed by designers who saw its historical references as a trite recycling of the past. Though they haven't designed any skyscrapers, it's worth noting that among the best work of the postmodern moment was that of Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown, whose practice more than any other defined a new direction during the 1970s. Next, please. Forgive this postmodern interview. Scott Brown recalled the couple's epiphany in 1966 when they cruised the Las Vegas commercial strip and its neon-lit casinos. She wrote, "Dazed by the desert sun and dazzled by the signs, both loving and hating what we saw, we were jolted clear out of our aesthetic skins." Their resulting book, colleague Stephen Isenor, was Learning from Las Vegas, a manifesto that, as a sign of its times, rejected the heroic modern mode and embraced ugly and ordinary architecture, Main Street buildings, billboards, roadside restaurants. They celebrated what Venturi called the decorated shed, next please, a utilitarian structure decked out with inexpensive ornament that mirrored the odd exuberance of the strip. Against the pure forms of knees, they put forth designs that incorporated fragments and above all the rich variety of buildings' contents. Against the museum dictum, "less is more," Venturi declared, "less is a bore." Among their more successful designs were showrooms for the catalog retailer Best Products, where superscale graphics played on the roadside aesthetic with unpretentious volumes and eccentric details that reflect and reinterpret the city around them. As the postmodern moment came and went, the energy meltdown spurred by the 1973 oil crisis shocked the US and other nations into reevaluating their wasteful ways. The result was the rise of sustainable design, a new focus that reflected ecological, not simply formal, concerns. Many architects in the 70s and 80s had embraced aspects of what would become known as green buildings, but it was not until Norman Foster's Commerzbank Tower, next please, in Frankfurt, in 1997, that one of the first full-fledged ecological office towers was born. With its 53-story triangular plan and a full-height central atrium, the structure embraced natural daylighting and ventilation, along with four-story vertical gardens spiraling around the building to create restful aeries for daydreaming clerks. And it was not long before private developers found that green design was not only good for the environment, it was good for the bottom line. Next, please. In New York, developer Douglas Durst was among the earliest to realize this when commissioning the city's first green skyscraper, 4 Times Square, the designed by Fox and Fowle with environmentally friendly features that have now become almost status quo. High-performance curtain wall, efficient cooling systems, and office furniture made with non-toxic materials. A more recent Durst project, one Brian Clark, next please, arranged the construction process to maximize sustainable practices. Architects Cook plus Fox used recycled materials like cement with blast furnace slag, along with a planted roof and storage tanks that capture and reuse rainwater to create an acclaimed green development. Sustainable projects like these prove that the shock of the new, that hallmark of modern design, could still be harnessed to socially redeeming ends. Next, please. The late modern era opened in the last decades of the 20th century and turned the corner to the 21st with a return to expressive, even outlandish forms that reflected new technological tools and perhaps a renewed appreciation after years of machine-age uniformity for each designer's unique stylistic fingerprint. At the same time, the modern ideal of form following function gained new traction as architects and engineers made ever bolder collaborative ventures into the world of tall building design. Next, please. Born a frame, Owen Goldberg, the man we know and love as Frank Gehry, opened a new front in late modern architecture that drew on his personal style rather than any particular concern with tradition or ecological imperative. From his base in Los Angeles, Gehry looked to the aerospace industry for software that made possible the creation of 3D models to describe the curvilinear forms of his later works, translating scribbles into construction documents and computer machined components. The well-known parade of blockbusters like the National Nederlanden Building next in Prague, whose joined towers swoon together on their site, and the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao next, created global sensations. Gehry conquered Gotham with the IAC building in 2007 next, which included the architect's first all-glass exterior, taking advantage of views over the nearby river. Hung from a concrete superstructure of tilting columns, the glass panels were bent into their final form on site, giving the building's bays a luffing, sail-like effect. Gehry's first skyscraper, however, is his soaring residential tower on Spruce Street, next. Considered by some to be the 21st century's answer to the nearby Woolworth Building, a 76-story tour de force that roused the slumbering Manhattan skyline with a stainless steel wake-up call. Embodying the arrival of the digital age with more than 10,000 computer-designed steel panels, the tower's vivacious form seems to ripple in the East River breezes, bringing the architect's sensual curves to the city's concrete canyons and announcing, at last, a worthy successor to the neo-Gothic landmarks of an earlier skyscraper era. The late modern moment introduced several highly original designers that pushed the tall building into new formal and arguably social territory. The cerebral Dutch architect Rem Koolhaas, next, remains in many ways the anti-Gehry, a canny critical thinker to Gehry's hockey-playing everyman. Koolhaas embarked on an investigation of the modern city. In Delirious New York and his massive book SMLXL, Koolhaas laid out a vision for the metropolis based on what he called Manhattanism, the unleashing of urban forces that give rise to a chaotic yet exhilarating culture of congestion. His Rotterdam-based Office for Metropolitan Architecture created its own think tank to focus on social and economic questions like the fate of European identity. Architecture, for Koolhaas, remains the realm of extravagant claims about urban possibilities. For all their differences, Gehry and Koolhaas are both driven by the modern quest for original forms, where Gehry drew upon his private language of ribbons and fish-like shapes, Koolhaas turned to museum modernism. Early works like the 1992 Kunsthalle, that's please, in Rotterdam, where sloping floor planes activate the structure as a continuous circuit dispersing visitors to exhibition halls and galleries, were forays into the use of programmatic elements to create a charged social space. These ideas were scaled up to a full city block when the Seattle Central Library opened in 2004, next please, translating Kuhlhaus's theories about dynamic urban life into an instance civic landmark. Let's go to the next slide. You are familiar with the Central Library, which has a training forum where librarians assist patrons with their interdisciplinary requests, with its faceted platforms bundled up in a sharp steel net. The structure is confirmation that urbanism still exists in the information age. Here, in a yet more complicated urban setting, OMA's China Central Television headquarters in Beijing is a new adventure in skyscraper form. Colossal loop-like structure whose two towers meet in a daringly cantilevered embrace. Designed with engineer Cecil Almond, the project deploys an external bracing system wrapping a diamond pattern around its skin. Where stresses are most intense, the pattern grows more dense while spreading out where less support is needed. The result makes the structure's underlying forces visible while creating a dynamically patterned facade. While the program includes a public access loop weaving up and around the structure, it remains a matter of debate whether Kuhlhaus's audacious Chinese experiment will yield a significant social payoff. As we pull up to the present day, we should not omit two women who have blazed their own distinctive trails through late modern architecture. Next, please. A one-time partner in Kuhlhaus's office, the Baghdad-born Zaha Hadid has created what is in some ways a merger of styles between Kuhlhaus's muscular modernism and Gehry's swooping exuberance. Drawing formal principles from algebra and geometry, Hadid conceived tightly choreographed public spaces like those of her first American project, seen here, the Rosenthal Center for Contemporary Art in Cincinnati, completed in 2003. Drawing on Kuhlhaus's sense of urban vitality, Hadid designed a continuous urban carpet, a ramp that pulls visitors in from the street and through the lobby, then curves upward to form the mezzanine gallery entrance. The structure itself, carved from interlocking concrete forms, is finished with accents of blackened aluminum and blue-tinted glass, offering a bold container for the museum's exhibitions. We're still waiting for any number of Hadid's skyscrapers to rise from the Cairo sands. Daring to rethink the tall building in the land of Louis Sullivan, in 2009, Chicago architect Jean Gang completed the 82-story Aqua, a melding of form and function that even Sullivan would applaud. Wrapping a conventional glass-clad residential slab in curving concrete balconies, Gang was inspired by the region's limestone outcroppings to create a sleek and sinewy facade. The overhanging shelves shade the apartments within while buffering fierce Chicago wind loads, their undulating pattern calculated to ripple away strong air currents with an ingenious ease. Writing for the New Yorker, Paul Goldberger called Gang one of architecture's anti-divas, reclaiming the notion that thrilling and beautiful form can still emerge out of the realm of the practical. I'd like to conclude with a not-so-tall building, yet one whose arrival captured the globe-spanning reach of our late modern moment and the promise of design to enliven our cities and our spirits. Next again, please. As the global capital of Tokyo became a hotbed of architecture in the 1990s, Japanese architects grew influential in the U.S., refining the aesthetic established by Mies and Gropius for a new generation. In 1995, Kazuyo Sejima and her collaborator Ryui Nishizawa founded the Tokyo firm Sana, using the initials for Sejima, Nishizawa, and Associates, and established themselves among the most innovative architects of the 21st century. Combining formal precision with an emphasis on public life, Sama commissions have reimagined museum spaces as part of the urban landscape. Their new museum sits akimbo on its Bowery site, wrapped in a metal mesh that pays homage to the restaurant supply shops that long defined this strip of workaday New York culture. The staggered, box-like volumes have been compared to children's building blocks casually piled up at the far end of Prince Street. Deft and sophisticated, yet with a disarming charm all its own, the tower prompts a smile whenever glimpsed against the backdrop of rough and tumble Lower East Side. Modernism's minimal forms reinvented as a life-affirming invitation to come inside and play. As we emerge out of the Bowery and into this eye-popping collection of super talls, I would leave you with just one thought that runs through the history of design, from Victorians like Morris to the utopian spirit of the Bauhauslers and on through today's crop of carbon-eating green buildings. Perhaps never before has design had such means at its disposal to realize a better world for all. In its catalyzing role across continents, as the modern movement continues to give form to our collective aspirations. In this book, we've tried to tell the story of those dreams and desires through the brilliant and still evolving language of design. As we build higher and heftier, whether at Ground Zero or in Shanghai, may this next generation of dreamers keep the modern spirit alive. Thank you.
Skipped Art Deco.
Art Deco.
Which is a pretty important Rockefeller thing.
That's true.
Is that in the book, or you done? Or you just didn't present it?
Whole chapter.
Huh?
An entire chapter.
Okay. But you didn't mention it, so.
Architecture, furniture, graphic design, it's all there.
Okay.
Including the whiplash curve.
Do you envision the book as a textbook to be used in coursework at Pratt or Parsons? Or
well, I explained to Jeff. I was asked to do this class at Pratt, and it was meant for first-year Pratt students.
And this is back in 1969,
and it was exactly meant to introduce photography students, graphic students, product design, interior design, and architecture students to the subject. Mm-hmm.
So, do you want to talk about how you decided to update?
Yeah, I comment to that point, though. I have to say, it's been such fun to work on this book that we should all be so lucky to be freshman design students at Pratt. I learned so much, and even though it has a certain progression as a textbook, even a design junkie like myself learned an incredible amount. And especially, I think, the way that you set up the first edition that explained it in a very clear progression, you know, and put it in context so that things made sense a lot more.
Thank you, Jeff. Many Sunday afternoons.
What they envision the future of architecture is just all about taller and taller, and how will you encourage the next generation to focus?
New materials. That's it.
I would say, I mean, it's an interesting question in the context of this exhibition. because we gave a nod to these super tall and the new, you know, very tall buildings in China and the Middle East, but we didn't really go there. And I think it became very interesting as we approached the present day, you know, how to make sense of the current moment. In some sense, we don't yet have that context. So, in a certain sense, we shied away from, I mean, we didn't even put the Ground Zero towers in the book, since, you know, it's not complete yet. Who knows what it's going to feel like once we're there. So I found that very interesting, just in terms of thinking about what the future holds, even thinking about what the present is. It's sort of hard when you're writing history. But I guess from my perspective, and I think from Anne's too, what comes through very strongly in the book is this social value of design. And I think we would hope to recapture that, you know, that spirit that modern design can change the world. You know, the shape of a teapot is powerful, as powerful as the shape of a building, and design can make a difference.
I attended one of the lectures on the Shanghai Tower, and I think, if I remember right, there were like cultural aspects of China incorporated into the design. But I maybe couldn't think of that.
Toss that question to Carol. What to do?
Well, Shanghai Tower is in this exhibition. It was in the China Prophecy exhibition as well, two shows ago, and you can see it in the case in the middle of the gallery. It's a tower that, when it is finished in 2014, will be the second tallest in the world at 632 meters, so it's just over 2,000 feet. And when we did present that team of architect, engineer, structural engineer, and MEP engineers, mechanical, electrical, plumbing, so it's building systems, the architect Jin Sha from Gensler did speak about the symbolism of the tower. And if you look at it in the model, it's a spiraling form. So it's a triangle that rotates as it rises, and as it ascends, it has a line in it that makes a curl around the building, and that is supposed to refer to this continuously evolving future of China, and this was very explicitly explained in the architect's remarks, and it was part of was incorporated in the client's understanding. But I think in relation to design, one of the things architects always describe about the process, and this was certainly true when we interviewed the architects and engineers for this show, is that when you're speaking to a client, you come up with a narrative in order to tell this kind of story, to sell, rather not just tell, to sell the story of the building. And so, and that's the narrative of the Shanghai Tower. I think books have narratives, even if they're just chronologies, and you made clear what the narrative of modernism is part of this book, and it has to do with value, moral values, which of course harks back to Nicholas Pevsner and Pioneers of Modern Design, which is the direct antecedent of this book, I think, is in a lot of the choices of the buildings, of the design objects that are incorporated. I think, though, that idea that this design and skyscraper design are kind of as close to commerce as architecture gets. I mean, skyscrapers are commercial architecture, and the teapot is meant to be sold in a store, whether it was William Morris or Michael Graves, you know, for Alessi or Target, you know, designing middle scale. That skyscrapers have to please the client, but they have to please the public, but they have to sell their space. And design needs to sell itself, whether it's to Porta and his haute bourgeois clientele, or whether it's yardage at Liberty, or, you know, sort of anything that has a fashion element to it. So I would say that you know, design and architectural design are very close in the way that they need to operate within the kind of the broad public and selling a story about what they represent.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the book, in its other parts, does explore more international architects and urban planners and more culturally sensitive approaches to design than some of the things that I showed today. But I agree, even so, you know, we are dealing with the Western narrative about what design is. Thank you.
The book seems it encompasses a lot of different professions, and I find it rather amazing. Do you think it's important for designers to kind of cut across scales and think about the everyday things that people like the tea kettle, as well as the everyday things like the cityscape?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think there are lessons to be learned, you know, and cross-fertilized from both realms. And that's part of what the whole Bauhaus ideal was about, you know, that one person goes through all these workshops and learns all these different random ways of designing things, and out of this comes a much fuller experience and kind of wisdom about how to design. So I definitely think it's part of the ethic of you know, this utopian spirit that we're trying to push here. Yeah.
How do you see the Empire State Building? I mean, the design of the Empire State Building. Is it among the modern buildings or the old colonial buildings? And which architect designed it?
Yes. Yeah, we don't
know. Lamb was the designer of the trio of principals in the firm.
Yeah, we don't dwell on the Empire State Building in the book, even though it's one of the obvious, you know, towers of skyscraper history.
Do you see it as one of the modern buildings or buildings?
Personally, I mean, sorry.
You say what they're calling it?
I'm talking about the Empire State Building.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what do you think?
About it?
Yeah.
Well, I think it was extremely important for the morale of the city when the building was undertaken at the height of the Depression. And the pictures that show the workmen out on the beams building it, for me, is a very moving story, a very moving image. And I still think that the Empire State Building is one of the great moments in New York City architecture. If I pass it in a taxi cab, I get a lump in my throat.
And it's an Art Deco building.
What?
It's an Art Deco building.
It's a what?
Art Deco building.
Art Deco building.
Empire State Building. Is it Art Deco?
Yes.
Was that the question?
I said it is an Art Deco building.
Well, I don't agree with that.
Well, I think it's,
I think it's the first expression of a contemporary modern building. But I suppose
go in the lobby. Go in the lobby.
Oh, in the lobby. Okay. In the lobby. That's good.
I just wanted to say something. I saw this exhibit, and it's wonderful. Very innovative towers and all that in China and all that. And the World Trade Center, Financial Center here, Trade Center, we have the most ugly common buildings compared to all of these innovative places in Asia. I remember when they first started, I think Barbara Linda Bell had a charrette, and they did four towers, and everyone said that was terrible. So they had a contest, I think 250 things at Max Potech, with all these innovative designs and wonderful things. And then what do we end up with? The same four towers going down from the big to the small, and that's what we got now. The worst thing you can ever get. So I don't know how, I mean, the government, everything, they had 900 people with their inputs, and this is what we got. And looking at this exhibit, these wonderful buildings, innovative, it's just terrible. I feel it's awful.
Yes, Jane, you want to add on a positive note?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to ask a question about the buildings and all the freedoms that people have had over the years to build their buildings. It's government regulation to build it in a town like New York. Does that inhibit anything new? I mean, the Gehry building just went up on Spruce Street, but we haven't had. And then that and the other building he did over on the west side. But it's very hard to get new buildings in a city like New York where it's so regulated, as opposed to Shanghai or in Beijing. Or am I wrong? I mean, does this influence what's built?
Well, that's a good question. I would say New York does have a reputation for being a tough place to push the envelope.
I must agree. I think good buildings can be built here just as easily as anywhere else. People are willing to build them. One Bryant Park is a good building. We see some good buildings happen. But we have such a wonderful city that everything sells. The least common denominator sells. And don't have to spend more money. They don't have to create a marvel to attract people. They can create the ordinary and make their profit. So this is a very difficult place. Thank God it's so wonderful that we'll always still want to be.
It's a difficult place with great people like you.
I just want to ask if you touched on, it's a short period, so I think the Sadism, because I thought that was an interesting period where, you know, they took the existing building and had the facade and then went up from there, so you kept the old feeling. I think it was, what, the 70s?
The Hearst Towers.
Yeah. But you said a lot of different kinds of buildings were going up.
Uh-huh.
I like that period because I thought, like, old.
Yeah, we don't directly talk about facadism, but it's kind of part of the, I think, growing variety of ways to reuse older buildings. You know, more and more adaptive reuse projects. That's very great to see happening in a place like New York, where for so long it's the modus operandi has been to tear it down and sold it into something new. So yeah, it's great to see history stay alive.
The other thing that's interesting, I recently went to an interior design magazine event, and it was the senior editor that was talking about the trade show that was in Las Vegas, and it was all about the design of like, half unbelievable designs, like faucets, and, I mean, they showed, like, how the shape of the heel, a red heel, heels on one shoe, was the design of the faucet. I mean, some of these faucets you hardly recognize. Or like that they had, who ever heard of them? This unbelievable industrial sized outdoor dishwasher. and toilets that were beyond recognition with remote controls on them, you know, to eight different settings. So it's just another form of design and what you can do.
So I think like a typical New York evening, community board We have even more opinions of New Yorkers than are even than are present sitting in our chairs. So I suggest that we get up and continue to talk amongst ourselves about all opinions about good and bad design, and offer questions, have a drink around the corner, some wine or some water, and some pretzels.